Good morning, good morning. This is Dan Platt from WCAA Albany, New York, alone in the studio today, so I will be tripping over myself between topics. Let's see if I can get some momentum as I talk about news, analysis, issues, and general points of interest from the radical left. This is the Three Left Show. Those three lefts stand for socialism, anarchism, and ecology. Three great tastes, different tendencies, multi-tendency show here, show and podcast online on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Hoping to be in more places soon. I'll be working on that as the month progresses. Until then, I have Patreon, and I'm online, and the website is threelefts.news. Okay, let's get started. We just had a primary yesterday. Wasn't mine. I'm a Green Party for life, I hope. And because it was several years ago, I was voting in a Democratic Party primary and noticed that I didn't actually like any of the candidates. They were all representing regressive policy to me. They were all representing conservatism of some degree. Even the progressive ones, not radical enough for me. So I move forward. I'm like, done with this. Enough of this. Law and order candidates for attorney general, a little fig leaf reforms, you know, just like, what are you proposing? Be bolder. And I got tired of thinking in my head, this isn't what I want. But there are people out there who do share my views and do want more reform and hashtag demand more. And that I found most of them in the Green Party. There are other groups as well, but many of them seem to have a hung up on working within the Democratic Party or working with them because, see, they're in power and such, and they need to cozy up. And I'm not really the bowing and scraping type. I was bullied too much as a kid, so I don't really like people who like being the boss of others. That is why governors like Cuomo and, of course, presidents like Trump will always be distasteful and enemies to me. So my name is Dan Platt, and more on my reaction to the primary. Maybe it's just my Facebook news bubble, but I saw more stories decrying the illegitimacy of the election, voter suppression, than I did about the results. The results seem to be secondary, at least in as far as my Facebook algorithm is concerned. Maybe it's because of all the way I talk to people and the stories that I usually look at, since I'm not really concerned about who wins the Democratic primary. Now, obviously, it would be good if the progressives did win. Certainly, any shift to the left is or left towards me. But that, unfortunately, did not happen in most cases. It certainly didn't happen when it came to the governor. Cuomo still won handily. This is because he had more money, he had more power, he had more people loyal to him for God knows what reason. You ask them, they cannot articulate it. It is truly just dogma, at least anecdotally speaking. But I would like to see some social studies on this. I think when it is studied, because I think it has been in some ways, people's political beliefs, it's purely tribalist, which isn't necessarily bad. I'm a bit of a tribalist at heart when it comes to community building and having boundaries around your identity, being a part of an identity. But it's just a matter of not being in competition with other groups, identities, communities negatively, which our economic political system obviously puts us against each other. And that is bad if I have to explain that to you. I'm sure you feel in your gut the way how fragmented our society is on all levels. Our culture is fragmented. It leads to all kinds of what's called alienation and confusion and wanting something different but not knowing what to do. And that's kind of the reactions to the primary is a kind of, to paraphrase, I know this is bull, but I don't know what to do about it. As far as my directives as voting early and often, I did that, and it didn't matter, or it didn't make a difference. Now, maybe there's a superficial differences that even the Green Party will explain that, like, look, even if we're not winning, we are pushing the Democrats further left by being an electoral threat, even if it's just by a few percentage points. That at least puts them in, you know, some fear that, oh, we could lose to Republicans. I mean, why would they be in fear of losing Republicans? Usually because they're very close. There isn't that much difference. Maybe on some social issues. Maybe on basically maintaining the status quo instead of regressing it further into depravity and feudalism. So this is my usual take on Democratic primaries in general. The one from yesterday, that's just the observation from what I was seeing, that more people are, maybe there's a growing consciousness there of a, what do we do now? Even after this Bernie-crat wave that, you know, with all this new energy that I'm told makes things different. Now it's different. Now we can take control of the Democratic Party. There's all this energy. And it's a little pessimistic here, but I'm not actually seeing it. I'm not seeing more energy, at least in my neck of the woods and in circles. And maybe I've been cloistering myself a little bit more this year in particular, taking a year off from canvassing electoral stuff myself, focusing on this show and doing this every week, kind of a part-time gig. But otherwise, I don't know how different it is. It seems this is playing out exactly like 06, even if there's this blue wave with the establishment Democrats winning. What are they going to do? They've already announced that they will carry on like they did in 06. Not going to expand deficits. We care about deficit. We're the financially conservative ones. Socially liberal, financially conservative. That's always a dog whistle to me for we're the status quo. We don't like changing anything, despite being an internal crisis. We just need to keep things going. And if you have a nice middle class job or position, that does seem that is very appealing. And it is in your interest to vote for that, which is why many do vote for Cuomo if they still, you know, if they're not on the precipice of poverty or what have you. And some even do because of, you know, the rhetoric and the advertising that he puts out. I mean, my Facebook was inundated with ads from him about how progressive he was and just total bull. He's a Republican and he just sometimes does what activists demand of him when a critical mass is reached, I suppose. And the rhetoric around the primary, as with all elections, which kind of something to struggle against, is the different views of electing people. And from the bourgeois, the managerial class, just think of your managers, your bureaucrats, your cops, anyone who's more about managing workers and being the ones who produce things, they see electing someone, or rather, like, who are they voting for? How are they voting for them? It's not, to me as a leftist, and usually this is like a left-wing perspective, and sometimes it's right-wing, the extremes, is you're voting for a platform, not a person. And it's up to that person you're electing to represent that platform. If they don't, they failed, and they need to be removed. And then, you know, they've betrayed you. And there's a platform, a set of ideals, a set of policies, actual identifiable things. For many, I'm seeing, at least in the voter base, the current, what's left of the voter base, it's, I'm voting for the person, and the representative who I'm going to trust with power. It's kind of a elect the dictator. And like, well, who's qualified to be the dictator? Who's qualified to be the boss of a state instead of the manager of policy and the proposer of policies? It's kind of disregarding the entire state apparatus of managers that would keep the state running even if there was no governor. But there's like a kind of who's qualified to be governor. And I was seeing some arguments among liberals that governor's just more qualified. And Nixon, not having held office before, being more half actress, half activist, maybe thoughts of the kind of way the South Park boys make fun of actors that do activism from their perches of privilege. Yes, anyone who has free time can do activism. And if you're raising a family, working a full-time job, and then some, you have no time for activism. It kind of works out that way. Even just a one day off is just spent with doing actually regaining your sanity. So I was reading a book. I think I mentioned it last week. The Liberated Man. So this is just kind of part two of talking about that. But last time it was in the context of feminism or something like that. I've been trying to take up some of the words. It's from the 1970s, that second wave feminism, radical feminism. And just like today, there's kind of experimentation of what kind of words to use for gender neutrality, as well as just moving beyond the kind of words that reinforce ownership in marriage of other people, control, the kind of dynamics that lead to domestic violence and just general bad, gross attitudes. So there's always experimentation of like having gender neutral pronouns, usually replacing, you know, the sh and the he with some other consonant, the H's and S's of she and he with some other consonant. Sometimes the popular one, at least in Scandinavia, is Z. So, ziz, says, Z. This writer uses T, so it's like T, te, ter, tez. Seems silly at first glance. It only kind of makes sense maybe in print that, you know, replacing all pronouns with these T alternatives. Less unwieldy is kind of instead of boyfriend, girlfriend, partner, even. Because partner can mean like partner in what? Partner in crime. But, you know, partner's fine, and partner seems to be working out in my circles. But he uses attaché, French word for, like, someone who's with you. And he proposes for someone you're sharing an apartment with, but not currently in a deep relationship, a living friend. Living friend. So I had that for a while. And I think many more millennials like me are having living friends. Obviously, good friends. You wouldn't share an apartment with someone who wasn't your friend. If you wouldn't, be roommates for long. And roommates sometimes doesn't do the job of describing. You know, like sometimes a roommate is by necessity, but a roommate doesn't like say it doesn't denote if you like them or not. So is it a good living arrangement? No, we're living friends. And an attaché is then someone stronger. Many different types of relationships. We should always think about the spectrum and the diversity of relationships. There's the platonic. There's the romantic that may not be sexual. There's obviously the sexual. And there's the sensual, maybe just like cuddling. No sex. Yeah, and that goes for me. You know, I'm really romantic. I don't really fall in love. Doesn't really make sense to me. And there's others like me. So it's forming, there's some kind of community around that shared experience, whether or not people think it's real or not. But, you know, I usually compare it to just the experience of being gay and saying like, well, would you ask a gay man like, well, you know, maybe you just haven't fallen in love with met the right woman. Welcome back. This is the Three Left Show covering news issues from a radical left perspective. And by radical, I mean fundamental change needed, almost revolutionary. In fact, you know, radical and revolutionary. But, you know, I'm not really acting like it. So just doing the outreach and the communication and the education via the show. Hope to fill the gaps between many other news sources and the kind of media, alternative for independent media out there. in which these point of views just are not allowed in the mainstream channels. But as far as the internet's concerned, we're reaching more people than corporate media these days, as more and more people just are giving up on corporate media. I mean, or I'm not maybe giving up on believing or trusting or like taking any of it seriously. Let's say half of their content is actually useful. It doesn't matter, because if the other half is bull, it's like, well, what's the good? I can't tell anymore. Or I have to work really hard to figure out what's the useful content, and do I have to sift through it all? Do other people have to do it? And then other people have to spend their time sifting through it all. And it's one thing to make fun of it, but I kind of have a rolling argument with people, you know, friendly argument, about consuming corporate media. When I say corporate media, I'm including New York Times, New York Post, and newspapers, what's left of them. Obviously, they're more online now. But even like, you know, kind of your standard articles and blogs, obviously anything on TV. Exceptions include some cable channels like RT, Telesaur, you know, outside of America. That's more important than, like, you know, who's funding it, who's owning it. Like, is it in America or is it outside America? Now, of course, if you're Team America, then I guess you need to consume American news from the perspective of the American corporate state. If that's your prerogative, fine, but don't count me as an ally. I won't count you as one. We are what we consume, what we eat. And our reality is based on the people around us and the media we consume, which is why I advocate that even if it's entertaining to you, stop watching corporate news, Fox News, your MSNBC. But even if it's entertaining, you're not taking seriously, you know, oh, it's the fluff pieces. It's still distracting from taking in more real information. And that includes stories that are nicer and fluffier. I mean, there's leftist fluff pieces. I'll look some up. In fact, I think the stories I'm going to cover for the rest of the hour, and then some, are much lighter. And they're certainly not like, oh, we got to do something right now. You know, not these aren't totally. This isn't the call to action show at this particular time. Not this episode. I think this is the chill and reassess some things show. So I'm going to cover a number of stories that kind of are different topics. They're not totally, you know, they're not like dovetailing, but they are from the same publication called Governing. And so it's a sort of a choice. I mean, unless it's an ingrained habit that you watch Fox News for the chits, for the giggles. And or MSNBC, because you just like how Maddow tears apart Trump every night and exposes or rather lets you know all of the terrible things he does and how corrupt he is. Now, I got news for you. Here's another piece of news. All capitalists are corrupt. All capitalists cheat. It's just a matter of degrees. There is a caveat, like, well, there's a small business owner. He follows all the rules, and he likes paying his taxes, and he's a good team community member. I'm not talking about them, because in some ways, they're capitalists in terms of being a small business owner. But what kind of capital do they really have? They might their business might virtually be owned by the bank. And as far as paying taxes, it's like owned by the city, or jointly. But of course, it's kind of virtually, not literally. Shared ownership by municipalities actually would be an okay thing to experiment with me. I need to look up the instances of municipalities that literally own and run a small business. So like they, just like any other city department, they hire people for, I remember it being a leftist fluff piece of a ice cream shop. The city owns an ice cream shop. All profits go into either the general fund or it goes into a separate fund for a particular program of the cities. So imagine the city, for funding its libraries or some other program, it starts a small business. Similar like having a bake sale every week. But instead of having a bake sale or some event that has to be organized every time you have one, it's work, or it's up to volunteers to do it, you actually have a substantial brick-and-mortar enterprise that then funds the program. And as long as people are going in there for ice cream, and it's, of course it can be run competently, you just, the city hires someone who can run an ice cream shop. Or, you know, it's a co-op, ideally. And the people you hire to work at it are then also part owners or part managers. So they may not be the owners, but they can be managers. Man, did I get off track. That's fine. It's the only way to fill time when one's alone. Doing a show like this. So here's I'm going to start with one of the commentary opinion pieces from governing. That's right. That's how I got on this. I was trying to figure out what is governing's point of view. And I would say it's conservative, but they explore the new ideas. They are open. So maybe they're not so conservative. But I mean, there's a point of view, but then there's the opining that things can be better. And I think it usually is a matter of like the fig leaf, what I call fig leaves, but the incrementalism changes, the incremental changes. So they'll point out incremental changes and talk about what kind of changes on the margins can happen. Now, there's the bigger way of completely restructuring our government, restructuring the way we think about what government does, what governance is. From an anarchist point of view, governance is people getting together and making decisions, but not letting other people do it for you. Especially when it comes to things that just affect you and people around you. But here's so I'm going to switch topics. It's racial justice cannot be achieved without this. And it's referring to integration. Something that's been missing from the national conversation probably since the days of the Civil Rights Movement. When the Civil Rights Movement kind of hit zenith and its leaders were assassinated, it's kind of presumed by conservative white people, middle class Americans, that the problem of race was solved by the mid-70s, maybe by the 80s. We didn't have big riots, race riots anymore. So the problem must have been solved. Unbeknownst to them, there was a war on black people by the police. There was big crackdowns and the mass policing of those communities. So organizing was broken up. Leaders were killed or jailed. And so the problem, racial problems were not solved. They were buried under police oppression. That is the narrative I go with. And I think there's a lot of literature and data to back that up. New Jim Crow, seminal work, is, and the prison, you know, and all the work concerning prison industrial complex, just look at the prison system as it is now. There are prison strikes currently going on. I think they've wrapped up now. More so, let's say, in the southern prisons in the path of the hurricane, they're not being evacuated. That goes to show how much human life is valued by our prison system. Not much. Because more people can always be arrested later to do that free work, that slave labor. So racial integration's been off the table, usually as a kind of like, well, it was so traumatic when we did it in the 50s and 60s. Such a national issue at the time. There's no real reason to do it again. It didn't work out. No one ever really says that, but they kind of do when they hem and haw about if it's ever brought up again. Or especially if just the issue of how segregated our cities are. No, I think only people who lean left and beyond will actually mention, talk about how segregated our cities are by race, by class, of course. And this is something that's only gotten worse over my lifetime. And I'll point out that this year, at least, it's kind of a new thing for me to notice, is our gubernatorial candidate, Abby Hawkins, has made integration, racial integration, part of the rhetoric in talking about education. So why? Because it's kind of tied to, you know, our schools are, you know, urban schools, black schools, minority schools are underfunded because schools are funded by property taxes, meaning they're funded in proportion to how rich people are. So richer people get better schools, poorer people get worse schools. I think shared county taxes would help alleviate this, but no, it's school districts within a municipal level. And so that means, you know, school district is only as good as its richest people. When really it should be only as good as its as a conglomeration of everybody. So racial integration is kind of the same as class integration. And he does mention class too, Howie Hawkins. Green Party people should do more of that. As anyone who says they represent, you know, the new democratic socialist movement. Greens are not particularly just democratic socialists, but we definitely have enough in our ranks. So this is by Mark Funkhauser, not a man of color, but former mayor of Kansas City, Missouri. In recent months, we've seen a rash of incidents, often captured on video, of police being called on black people going about normal everyday activities, such as two men sitting in a Philadelphia Starbucks, which you may have heard, waiting for a business associate, or police were called on them for, you know, wanting to use the bathroom, or a Yale student falling asleep in the lounge of her dorm. Police were called on her because she was seen as not being a student there. She was assumed not to be a student. Why? She's black. These incidents have come to be characterized as examples of the hazards and frustrations of living while black and endemic racism. A word about endemic racism in the North versus the South. And this is just a observation. You can see how it clicks with you. In the South, minorities can be near you as long as you don't rise in class at all. You know, you have to be on the bottom. In the North, you can rise in class, be middle class, be well educated, but you can't be near me as far as the attitudes are concerned. And so let's see if that clicks for you. You know, it's, and that's historically based. You know, if blacks come to the neighborhood, that's always what's prevented. Not that blacks can be middle class and in the workplace. You know, it's, we want those tokens around. Anyway, on tokens. Other than a lot of hand wringing, I haven't seen much of a public policy response to this issue. Black Lives Matter has policy planks for combating police brutality and police violence. But not so much on this generalized structural racism of people calling the police on black people, basically living their lives and doing everything everyone else does. Cooking in the park, so on. But there is one that clearly works, pursuing racial integration as a policy goal. As Elizabeth Anderson, author of the 2010 book, The Imperative of Integration, told me, a lot of research suggests that racial prejudice is triggered when blacks are tokens. That is, when whites see blacks in places where they don't usually see them. It's pretty much impossible, Anderson says, to exaggerate the extent to which racist behavior is motivated by fear. On the other hand, steady racial contact has positive effects in diminishing stereotypes. I think everyone, not everyone, but I think people who care about racial issues know that one, the main antidote is being around the other. Lessens fear of others. You learn and understand more. You build solidarity. At least as far as your individualistic American can of, well, they're just working hard like me. We're still competitors, but and I'll destroy them in the marketplace. Or, you know, that's usually a lot of the fear is the fear of taking jobs, the fear of the competition. But the outcry is never against the competition, the pitting of workers against workers. That's always seen as being a natural force, like hurricanes. But being a socialist anarchist, I don't believe that. I believe markets are, in fact, constructed, like our state, like gender, like our opinions about art. They are constructed by our experiences and choices made by people either long dead or currently living. So that means we can do something about it. We are masters of our own destinies. We need to believe that first and foremost. Anderson's argument that it's an illusion that racial justice can be achieved without integration makes sense to me. And this is the mayor, former mayor speaking. And I'm surprised by the absence of any discussion of it when we talk about how to achieve racial equity. Perhaps that is because people see integration as impractical or unworkable. Personal experience. I've seen the racial integration policy sometimes when it comes to like housing is twisted into being class integration. But of course, class is a banned word almost. So income range. It's like, we'll have a policy of like, you know, 30% of the housing goes to low income, right? Low income, code for working class, but also code for minority. Moving on, the residents of Oak Park, Illinois, known otherwise, Rob Beamer, the chief operations officer of the Chicago area nonprofit Heartland Housing, has worked in Oak Park for years. Anderson refers to him as the world expert on how to pull off successful neighborhood integration. Oak Park, suburb, adopted a strategy of promoting integration in the 1970s, initially met with acrimonious debate and opposition. It has changed the culture of the community, sometimes depicted in the literature, the Raisin in the Sun play. Embracing integration, Beamer says, is not only about building acceptance of diversity and calming racial fears, but also about driving prosperity by supporting a strong housing market, among other economic benefits. Basically saying it makes everyone richer to have a diverse set of people in a area. That's, or community too. That's particularly important in an era of major demographic change with people of color making up an increasingly percentage of the population. For central cities and inner ring suburbs, like Oak Park, they're like almost urban. Embracing integration is a competitive advantage because African Americans know they will be well treated and accepted. I don't know how that's done. There are clear strategies that communities can adopt to promote integration, including educating landlords. I'd like to know what the actual content of that is, educating landlords, because when it comes to the landlord-tenant dynamic is poor people have bad habits when it comes to taking care of housing, breaking things, or not being able to fix things, having a skill set that usually just comes to those who own their house, because, you know, if you own it, you have to fix it. You have to call the plumber. If you're a tenant, you don't. It's usually left up to the landlord, but they have to be dependable. So educating them is almost educating them on being dependable, responsible managers of property. Or sometimes when it comes to owners who aren't the landlord but live next door to someone who's poor and of color, there usually be a complaint of they don't take out their trash properly, they don't recycle, and maybe I'll ask them, like, well, did you try talking to them? And there's might be an assumption that they wouldn't listen, and I get that, you know, hey, like, oh, look, this richer person's telling me what to do. Hell to that. But usually I needed some kind of gift, you know, let them know you care, that they're valued, buy them something. Yes, it'll cost you something. You know, if you think about it like a bribe, but it's also a matter of being social. I mean, you buy gifts for people you like. Is that a bribe for them to keep being your friend? I kind of askew gift giving most of the time, which probably makes me a very bad community builder. but I'm kind of poor and can't afford it. So then he wraps up. So these articles are shorter. That's why they're good for right now. There are clear strategies. I just read that. And then he quotes Martin Luther King, basically at how integration is the ultimate goal of our national community, with desegregation being the means. If we want to do something more than bemoan living with black incidents, we need civic leaders to reclaim racial integration as a policy goal. Now, I'm agreeing because the Greens have done just that. And not many other mayors, Democratic or otherwise, have. He wrote this, obviously, because he is a former mayor. He's not mayor anymore, so maybe he can be a little more open about this stuff. That's usually the case. You basically become independent again when you're not in office. But what if you could be in office and be independent? Well, that's what third parties are for. Welcome back to the third section in the first hour of the Three Left Show. So continuing with our stories from governing the states and localities, a kind of news article. Oh, actually, no. I'll wrap up the hour with the other thing I was kind of starting with. I totally started the train of thought about notes from the Liberated Man, and then I went into something else entirely. But in the same vein as integrating race and class is the integrating of ideas and viewpoints together. Again, it's a matter of proximity and what people are seeing on a regular basis. And as I was suggesting 20 minutes ago, stop taking in corporate media and Pentagon narratives of what's happening, say, in Venezuela, Iran, Korea's, any international news that's through the lens of the CIA. I'm not kidding. And take in narratives at least through their point of view. All right? Yes, it's biased if it's through China's point of view and their news media. But that's still a lot better. It's more than what you would have had. The exposure to like, oh yeah, these are their people. And yes, China's government is doing horrible things right now. They are practically genocidal against the Muslim Uyghur population in the eastern western portion of the country. But anyway, a little section from The Liberated Man. And this is about like a radical men's liberation movement to be in parallel with the women's liberation movement, because you got to liberate men from gender stereotypes too. And women's liberation doesn't particularly do that. Just see how we have a men's rights movement, which is completely reactionary and twisted, because third wave feminism was pretty exclusionary as far as welcoming men. And it's kind of a perennial argument / tension in radical activist circles of that minorities, oppressed people, the most oppressed, need to be the leaders. And I accept that wholeheartedly. But there's kind of a attitude that then cishet white men like me shouldn't be in any leadership position. We need to be complete followers. And this goes counter to a lot of people's natures or their ingrained habits. Now, sometimes the habit of always needing to be the leader and the one doing things and not following the lead of women and oppressed peoples is something to be unlearned and understood. And that's part of consciousness raising. But then there's also kind of a tension of, well, how submissive do I have to be to what this women-led leadership is? And are there then any spaces where, you know, I'm in control, as a cishet white man? And so it's a matter of developing our own spaces, even spaces for men, safe spaces for men. For their own consciousness raising, to talk about women and how to better to raise them up, as well as break our own conditioning and bad habits, and of course the smash the patriarchy kind of conversations. back to radical change, how to make radical change, how to swing people's opinions, how to get people on your side. You know, is it really just making the best rational argument? There's a lot of moderates that speak this way. I think they are delusional in their trust in, first, that the American democratic system is the best possible system, and we can't have anything better. So their default, almost, they're very conservative. They just want to maintain our shambles of democracy, our election system. They decry money in politics. They decry all the things that I hate. But then when it comes to doing something about it, they are utterly impotent. All they have is either almost reactionary opinions about we are waiting for right-wingers and reactionaries to die of old age, or killing them, but not actively, obviously. They're not monsters, but more passively. Like, let all the poor whites in Arkansas just die from their ignorance about opioids and their dependence on fossil fuel jobs. Well, they don't want to change and get educated, then that's on them. Totally individualistic, total failure. So it describes four stages of kind of development, like the stages of grief, but these are the stages of how people's opinions, people recenter towards a more radical position. So the first is that usually people are repulsed in their first exposure, usually at a distance, of public radicals. So speaking from the author's point of view in the early 70s, he's talking about radical feminists. Let's say their position is women should be able to work in the workplace without being harassed, or be able to work in jobs besides teacher, secretary, nurse. Now, that's completely normal now because of their extremism, because that was the extreme position. And at first, everyone was repulsed by it. All of these bra burners, in these days, it would be, well, a decade ago, feminazis, so on and so forth. But then, stage two, a few weeks later, said person might be taking up some of those radical positions, thanking them, maybe even expressing them, but in a way that does not bemoan not tell you where it's sourced. You know, they distance themselves, and they have an aversion for mentioning where they got these thoughts. They'll say, like, well, you know what they say. And they may even forget where they heard it, or they do, but they will not admit where they got this idea. It's like, well, you know, wages maybe should be over $15. We need living wages, after all. It's what they say. Politicians do this every day. They will, if they take up a new position, they can't make it seem like they've changed their mind about something. So they'll basically act like they always believed it. Because otherwise, I mean, they'd have to say, like, well, these activists had a good point, and I listened to them, and I changed my mind. It's interesting that some people elect other people for their flexibility, or their inflexibility. Like, well, I like how this guy is consistent, and he doesn't change his mind. And I don't know, I wonder how many elect people based on, like, well, he seems malleable. Like, you know, if we make a good case to him, then he'll change his mind. He may have a position against single payer now, but once we talk to him in office. But there's kind of a joke about, like, even democratic socialists. Like, running for office, they'll be saying single payer for all. The day they're elected, on election day, they'll say, well, Medicaid needs to be expanded. What happened to IF for everyone? No, it needs to be expanded. We just need healthcare reform. And then once they're in office, it'll be like, well, I've endorsed a plan to gamify healthcare. Your ability to see an optometrist is now based on your Candy Crush score, which feeds into this algorithm that creates value for this tech company. That will be their... There'll be a policy backslide. Recent example, more concrete is Ocasio-Cortez, where, you know, running probably had a pro-Palestinian rights kind of stance, supported BDS on the website. Today, she's wins the primary. It's those things are taken off her website. And then when asked about it, and being the kind of representative-elect already, and then when asked, like, well, I believe in their rights, but I don't want to do anything about it. Back to the fourth stage. So the last stage was taking on the position in a public way, but not mentioning the source, or not even remembering what the source is. Stage three is a little more concrete in that you do take on the position, okay, radical pet feminists, the socialists have a point, and I do believe in this, but it is unsafe for me to be public about it. I'm surrounded by people who don't think like that. They will ostracize me. It could just be a matter of having a different religion or religious belief. Many different ways this can play out. Okay, I'm not just talking about economic beliefs or partisan stuff. This can literally be a bit like a matter of religion or being secular or just being different. You know, you otherize yourself if you know that the rest of the people, like, and in the context of feminism, okay, the rest of my buddies see women as meat, and it would be totally uncomfortable, and I don't want to fight with them by bringing up that I believe women aren't meat. And we shouldn't be talking about women that way, and we should stop catcalling. But they have the internal belief that they can. So they can't or won't identify with the movement, radical movement, but move to, personally, the moderate position. But the new moderate position, it's a new moderate position created by a new extreme in the marketplace of ideas. And the moderate position that they're moving to, that's acceptable in some ways, at least to themselves, was yesterday's last extreme position. So let's say, as an actual socialist, I am okay with socialized healthcare. I am okay with government enterprise, nationalizing things. I don't think it's really the best strategy overall, being anarchistic as well. I want bottom-up change. And that's probably as effective as it will be here in America. It usually is bottom-up change in any case. But all the conversation about healthcare, Medicare for all, single payer, which is government paying for it, but provision, but it's still private enterprises providing the healthcare. It's just not the insurance that's private and for profit. So it really helps. It's de-privatizing a good section of our healthcare system, which is the paying for it. Then there's the providing for, which is still kept private, entrepreneurial, let's say. It's not really, of course, it's really consolidated here. The last one is what you might guess, integration of some type, where there are enough people who share the same opinions around you, either virtually or otherwise, to give you the confidence to identify with the movement. And it creates a new reality around you. Reality of my community, or rather people around me, family, friends, are okay with these radical views, this new normal position that women can work in the workplace, or we can have government pay for health care, it will save us all money, and so on and so on. And maybe we shouldn't have a big empire and be at war in 9 countries. Radical change. 4 stages. See if you've encountered it in your own life. Have you ever changed your opinion in that? And did it happen in those ways? Did you need people around you to feel comfortable having a new position? Or are you just so much of a rabble rouser that you just go like, I believe this and I'll argue with you. That takes some real confidence. You have to be economically secure to do that, because, like, you know, if you could be fired or ostracized so that your family doesn't help you anymore financially or otherwise, invite you to parties, they lock you out. It's damaging, traumatizing. And nobody actually wants to risk it. Don't blame them. This has been the Three Left Show. We're wrapping up the first hour. And when we, after the break, I will be playing some music. Be well.
Around, always lost, not found, but I didn't realize. Like a giant standing in my way, leading me astray. Now it's time for me to rise. I knew I had to find myself. Turns out I'm on my own.
Your host, Dan Platt. This is the Three Left Show. Three lefts. Those three lefts are three flags. One for anarchism, one for socialism, one for ecology. Multi-tenancy show, bringing you radical opinions and analysis from me, your host, activist, know-it-all Dan Platt. I won the sign war of 06-17 because wars are fought with signs. So with the rest of this section, I'm going to go back to governing, the kind of clearinghouse of municipally based stories. You remember various controversies ongoing, actually. It's almost a movement that kind of perks up now and then on the news feed about tearing down statues that offend us liberal leftist snowflakes. But let me just make clear, symbols, as George Carlin put it, are for the symbol-minded. And especially when those are symbols of a imperialist genocidal mindset, one that currently pervades American foreign policy and internal policy. So if we want to change that, or at the very least gesture towards a change, towards a position that that mindset is illegitimate and not supported by some amount of the public. And that is why sometimes we leftists and liberal snowflakes take direct action and don't wait for cities and courts to decide when symbols of white supremacy, racism, and genocide get to be taken down. We do it on our own. And this is happening more in the South, where things are worse and more pervasive. Not so much in the North, because we're all such good liberal cities where such attitudes do not pervade here. Unless, like I said, if people of color start moving into a neighborhood where there weren't before, there are then a stink is raised about usually along class lines. But there's always that hint there. Dog whistle words are used. Happens here in my own hometown, and it's the fractured nature of our society. To fix this, integration is suggested. And this does not mean we all need to be in one big community. I think it's important that we have boundaries denoting our own identities. But what I argue is that those identities need to break from the past. What am I talking about? I advocate usually that we, if you are of fairish skin color, that one should not, if you can help it, identify as white. Can there be white supremacy without whiteness? And of course, it brings up the question, what is whiteness? Now, I define it as being part of that mindset that I am different from everyone else who I do not, I or the government does not determine to be white. So sometimes there's a fight from minority communities to either be labeled and accepted by the state as white or by other groups, almost kind of campaigns that we are white. It's what Italians and other Europeans did or could do. But of course, then there are those that are definitionally speaking can never be white, particularly those that are black. Now, if you're Native American, First Nation, if you are Mexican, I think, or even just anywhere from Latin America, whiteness will not be in the cards for you. Can you fight for whiteness? Not really. Could you ask, you know, what would it take to accept your Mexican neighbors to the Trump supporter? And I don't think there's anything they could do. They could, you'd say they work hard. They're good, industrious Americans, individualistic, religious. Check all those other boxes that could make the right winger more comfortable. But at the end of the day, they aren't white. Can there be white supremacy without whiteness? I would say no. I think we should at least experiment by pretending whiteness doesn't exist. And this always makes, you know, I always get a pushback of some type. I think it's just a really out there idea. And that's what the show is for, out there ideas. But what I'm relating this to the statue fight against racist statues. And there's a more recent story here, published just yesterday, by the Tribune News Service, but I'm getting it via that governing site. Native American, I say First Nation because they don't consider themselves to be Americans. America is a European concept, okay? So they're not Native Americans. They are First Nations, the First Nations of this continent that they call Turtle Island. Statue to come down, Native American statue to come down in San Francisco. Now, this is kind of a bad headline because when I read it, I thought, wait, is this a statue of a First Nation person? Well, no. It's a part of a set of civic statues, sculptures, actually, that depicts a vaquero, a settler, I guess, and a missionary standing over a fallen and nearly naked Native American. They use American Indian. Again, can you keep your term straight, please? Could be coming down as early as next week following a unanimous vote by the city's Board of Appeals Wednesday night. The vote reverses the board's earlier decision and bookends a decades-long fight. Decades-long, okay? So this is where my real revolutionary slash insurrectionary kind of politics come in, is I really dislike how long going through the legal process takes. Any legal process seems to take decades, all right? Whether you're lobbying for a policy, even if it's just a minor reform, it takes a year of campaigning just for one little reform that could be overturned the next year. Like these court decisions, they just keep getting repealed, and it's a never-ending cycle of pearl clutching about Roe v. Wade. Oh, is it going to be overturned this time? Is it going to be over? We have to keep electing Democrats for their court picks. And I'm like, well, this seems like we're fighting a never-ending battle to have a conservative court that maintains the court decisions we like, but then keeps carrying down court decisions that then completely make our position harder, you know, making money political speech. as an example. So, to continue. This has been a tough 30-plus years, but this is wonderful, said D.D. Yahara, an Ohlone tribal leader who urged the commissioners to remove the statue. Wonder how old she is. I don't want to be old when I, you know, hit a political goal. I really don't. I want it to happen soon. And when it comes to removing the statue by force, meaning like as a mob and just putting vandalizing in the middle of the night, you know, the phrase direct action gets the goods. Okay? Because we're not talking about actively hurting anyone. I mean, certainly hurting those that are in power and depend on white supremacy and this veneer of historical legitimacy of wars are good and we need to honor those who died and that it was all for good. And that means that the wars we're fighting now are good. They're not. That's why these symbols need to be fought, taken down. San Francisco's Arts Commission and Historic Preservation Commission had both signed off on a proposal to remove the early days statue and put it into storage. But the plan was frozen after appeal, yada yada, city standards. Sculpture is one of five bronze statues that make up a pioneer monument, an 800-ton shrine to the settling of California planted between the main library and the Asian Art Museum. The Board of Appeals sided with Schmidt in April, largely on the grounds that the Historic Preservation Commission erred in approving the statue's removal because it would change the Pioneer Monument's historic character. But the appeals board granted the city a chance to make its case for removal. So this is like a Historic Preservation Commission, which is usually separate from city government, granted by some other, you know, charter. The Arts Commission had originally proposed, so you have a historic preservation that wants to keep it as it is. You have an Arts Commission that proposed removing the sculpture last year. So it's been a 30-year-old effort, but it got new life. Why? Because of the recent demonstration in Charlottesville, Virginia, at the site of a Confederate statue. That rally, which resulted in the death of a counter-protester, they're not giving the name, it's Heather Heyer, started a national reckoning around removing historical monuments that, to many, glorify racial or cultural oppression. Though some say, again, they won't say who, oppressed communities, minority communities, those who, you know, young people. This reporting style, I don't like it, but that's I'm going to add what's missing. Okay, but I'm out of time for this section. It is going to come down after 30 years of trying to do it, but it was because of the direct actions of the past year that is getting the legal gears moving, greasing those processes where the sensible are like, well, we got to do something. We got to get ahead of this before it's taken down by a mob. All right. So maybe we don't need complete mob rule, but just the threat that the mob, as a subsection of democratic will come forward to do it regardless of the law. Because the law, as far as many communities, and maybe even you on an economic level, the law has failed you. And kind of to how I'm going to edge into this next story, which is a complete example of the duality of surface level reporting. You know, maybe looking at stats, maybe consulting a expert. And let's see, this is written by the governing site here under the finance section. A troubling trend for cities, slowing revenue but rising spending growth. So as I'm talking and reading out this piece here, not too long, is to think about, well, the theme is there's a need for progressive taxation. So I'm going to be repeating that. But as I mentioned in a previous episode, and maybe you might not know of it, but any effort for progressive taxation, there was one in Seattle recently. And maybe you could think it was just Seattle because it's Seattle. That it was the progressive tax was passed and it was immediately, over a few months, repealed because the forces of the ruling class, upper class is the 1% as they're called, responded in force with the force of their money and an army of hired people because people are desperate and are willing to be class traitors, right? You know, progressive taxes would help them and everyone they know and people they don't know, of course. But that temporary paycheck of doing some grunt work, some ground game, some outreach on behalf of the ruling class, the big companies, Google, Facebook, et cetera, the billionaires. Yeah, there needs to be a solidarity. You know, when people go on strike, there's usually scabs. And part of solidarity with striking, and the only reason strikes work historically is because when one group goes on strike, everyone does, or at least enough do. To say, well, if the MTA goes on strike, I guess I won't go to work. I'll accept not being able to go to work for a week because we need a better subway system. And I believe something needs to be done, so I support that. I'm going to take a position. It takes a bit of courage, but if it takes a little practice to get into the mindset of solidarity, of caring about other people, and knowing that their goals are also your goals, and that what's good for one section of society is good for everyone. And too often, it's seen as an individualist thing of, like, say, activists block traffic. They're inconveniencing all of these other people. But no, it's these activists are trying to save society and they need to be supported. They are not inconveniencing people. It is that our society is fractured and broken. That is the inconvenience, and something needs to be done about that. And the thing about striking is an example that sometimes the best thing to do is to do nothing, to stop. But of course, in doing nothing, one usually gets bored, and then you find that you might do something you wouldn't do normally. Something else. Something more social. Something more organized than this. You know what? You know, since I usually don't get the chance, but seeing as I'm alone, I want to have a slight rant, not at anyone's particular expense. To turn it back to electoral politics, I know I'm segueing away from what I was going to talk about, but I already kind of talked about it. There's a need for progressive taxes because revenue is growing. Like, you know, cities aren't taking in enough revenue, but they still need to spend money, and growth in spending is a result of inflation and all that. But I want to talk about political independence. In regard to the need to be organized, right? You have no power if you're alone. There seems to be, it's part of American dogma that you as an individual are strong and powerful, but we're only as strong as the people around us. And if there's no one around you, no one got your back, you don't act in a group of any way, socially, what are you? That's what I see when there's protests usually. It's a lot of individuals, but there's no organization. And the same goes for, at least on paper, the growing number of registered independent. And when I say independents, I'm not talking about some independence party or an independent party. They are registered as no party. And I want to put out an open question. Who does that affiliation serve? I'd like to ask each person registered as independent, why they, how is it useful to them to be independent? Usually because they are fed up with the two parties, rightfully so. They do not want to be counted as members. That is the usual baseline reason, and that is a good reason. But then I want to ask, why are you nothing instead of switching to a minor party that you may identify with? Now, some are, in fact, have such a jumble of beliefs, they don't consider, they don't, maybe they just have an ingrained assumption they don't belong to any minor party. They can't. And they're looking and they're waiting, maybe they're waiting for a minor party to come along that they fit with. That always feels like, sounds like a fool's errand to me. What are they waiting for? What would it look like? Do they even ask these questions? Maybe they have. I don't hear these conversations. Especially among podcasts and others who sound and maybe identify as independents. They certainly don't identify with any party. Some podcasters like Jeremy Dore will keep pining about the need for a third party, but it's like, okay, are you going to join one? Right? These minor parties can't replace the major ones without more members. Not just registered members, but obviously members that support them financially as due-paying members, as the Green Party is trying to do that. But you know, active members, or even just on paper. Every little bit helps. Because what is your, who is your independent serve? Do you feel more powerful? Because what I see instead is a lot of conversing, especially with the recent primary here in New York and in other states that have closed primaries. And you have these political independents who want to seem to have it both ways. They want to affect the Democratic Party or Republican Party. They want to affect the major parties. They want to, they're wrapped up in how important the major parties are and because they have power. And, but they want to maintain the sense that they do not belong to it, that they are independent. It's, to me, a lie. I'm being strong about it, okay? I'm using strong language here. I don't, you know, it's not a literal lie. But it seems like a sham that, you know, like, to say you're no party. It's like, no, you are. I mean, it's kind of like how the neutral position is for the status quo. I kind of feel like the independently registered voter is trying to, like, have everything. They want to affect the Democratic Party and whine about how the primaries closed. Oh, why can't I not be a part of it? And they don't want me to vote in it. You answered your own question, Don. You answered your own question. I think it's really childish or immature. It's an immature state of mind to me. I'm being really mean. And these are all potential allies. These are people. But, you know, I'm going to be a little aggressive here. We've been nice, but like. Ralph Nader, right? Ralph Nader is associated with the Green Party, but he has never actually been a member of the Green Party. It's why he doesn't do anything. I mean, no, I'm sorry. He'll work with Greens and fundraise and stuff, but he still won't be a party member. And because he isn't, that's why he hasn't run as a Green Party candidate again, because us as a party, we don't really want him to. We want him to be a member. We want him to say, I'm joining. Because what hits me is, I don't know if you've seen it or not, but The Last Jedi. Okay, The Last Jedi has a character. He's a hacker, and he's just thrown in. He's comes out of nowhere. He's not actually the guy they're looking for, but he was there. He seemed to be able to do the job. And he has these lines about, look, I'm free because I don't join. I don't join the Empire. I don't join the Rebellion or the Resistance or whatever. I'm out for myself. And he betrays our main characters, causes the deaths of a lot of people, but he just considers it as, well, I'm just looking out for me. I don't join. And, you know, Finn, main character, says, like, you know, what you're doing is wrong. You're in the wrong. You're wrong about that. not joining. And he goes like, maybe, you know, he's just gray about it. And he's just a weaselly, you know, he's written as a stutter, you know, snake. And, you know, apologies to snakes. That's kind of what I picture when I read comments about independents complaining about how they weren't allowed to vote in yesterday's primary. They're not like, you know, traitors to the cause or something. But they also don't want to join any movement. Or maybe they are part of movements. Apologies to them. It's a very diverse. I mean, a side project of mine that I haven't devoted any time to because it is like a year-long project would be to canvass every no-party registered voter in my city of Albany, because there are as many no parties as there are all the other minor parties and Republicans, which is a minor party here in the city, combined. There would be a substantial voting block. But what are their politics? No one knows. Do they even know? Open question. When I canvass, my observation is that they are like that snake of a hacker. Non-joiners, don't want to be identified with any movement or group. They want to be neutral, safe, don't join. Kind of like they're not all like selfish, you know, like I'm just in it for myself. Many of them are like community people and have community-minded thinking, and they're like, well, you know, I like, you know, this neighborhood, people like each other. They're not bad people. But as far as changing the world for the better, they're amazingly impotent. Useless. As I run for office, I will canvass them. Go out my way. But how many of their votes are gained? Can they be convinced to vote for a minor party? Join a minor party? Open questions. I think I'd like to actually have a full debate with one. I think I need to find an activist who is registered independent here in Albany and maybe have this conversation not one way. Because I'd like to hear them defend their position. Why haven't you joined anything? A party? What is your political power, electorally speaking? Because from where I'm standing, it's zilch. At least the Greens can make the argument that we are affecting the conversation. What do independents do? There's a force that's, you know, to be reckoned with. But in the end, they're just considered the undecideds. Maybe because they themselves haven't decided what they believe, what they stand for, what are their positions. This is something we all should do. Because otherwise, how can we even talk about what to do about our problems? Personal or otherwise. Personal or structural. And part of the show is arguing that, you know, they're both kind of the same. Structural problems are personal problems. When we have mass inflation because our currency system is all screwed up, obviously, basic food prices rise and that causes stress. Makes our lives harder. It's all one, you know, very Eastern philosophy. Leftists have a perchance for Eastern philosophy or integrating it with European philosophy. So on philosophy of there's a wholeness, a oneness to things, interconnectedness. It's not that there isn't individual things like ourselves, but, you know, it's both are true. Okay, Dan Platt here back. Temporary, I think. I just want to go through the housekeeping. So I do this show from 10 o'clock to noon every Saturday live here at WCAA, the place for community-run and owned independent media on the airwaves. And this show itself is also a podcast. Go on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher to download the last 10 episodes. Full archive of episodes, besides the last 10. This is currently episode 23. I didn't mention that, but really important. can be found at 3lefts.news. Just update that archive so you can just go to that page and all the episodes are there. Full descriptions and sources, not quite listed, so don't be surprised if it's a little blank and it's just the title of the episode. Sorry for that. But I believe in the coming weeks I am taking a week off, so I will definitely spend the time to fill that in and do all those other things like job searching and other business to make my life in order and perhaps reshuffle my schedule so that I can make the show even better. I'm lacking in kind of audio gags and reels and having recording this so that I don't have to do a live housekeeping. But otherwise, we're on Facebook and other social media. Twitter can be contacted via Twitter, Facebook page at 3lefts.show. I have one Patreon. Shout out to Josh, who is just texting for my opinions this morning. Friend Josh and friend of the show now. If you'd like to be mentioned on the show and have a consulting, be able to consult what issues I cover, please become a patron at patreon.com/3lefts. So thank you very much. Signing off, Dan Platt, thank you for joining me, and thank you for being who you are, wherever you are, however you are. Just remember, it only happens if you take action.